It never amazes me. No, it always, sorry, when I say never, it always amazes me how we never have an end of subjects to talk about here on Continuing Conversations, especially with our everlasting goal to make the game more inclusive and more celebratory of infinite diversity in infinite combinations. So today's an amazing topic. I'm Michael Dismuke. I am a blogger on Continuing Missions, which is the number one fan site for Star Trek Adventures RPG and Captain's Log, in addition to being a freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures, a lead writer on Captain's Log. And now, of course, by the time this has come out, an actual fiction writer for Star Trek Explorer magazine, which I'm really happy about. Today's topic is actually going to be talking about opening up the game even wider for people who are neurodivergent on the spectrum. How do we invite them to the table to engage and have a bunch of fun, learn and grow from that? But before we jump into that subject, let's introduce our guest, but let's first introduce Jim Johnson.
Hey, everybody. Jim Johnson. I am the project manager and line editor for the Star Trek Adventures RPG and the Captain's Log solo RPG, both published by Modiphius Entertainment. Co-host on this here show with Michael Lowe, these 100-something episodes, 2 years plus, going strong. And gosh, I think I think the shows are getting better and better. And the biggest reason for that, I think, is the caliber of guests we've been able to attract to the show somehow. And like tonight, we've got an all-star cast, and I am so humbled and so thrilled that you all decided to join us tonight. So thank you all so much. I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves, and then we'll jump into the topic. And just to tie in to something Michael was saying, I would love to also hear, like, not only how do we invite folks to the table, but like how do, and this is me shamelessly being the project manager, how do we make our products more accessible to people, right? Like, I know that's something that we're trying to do at Modiphius, and other game companies are trying to do that as well. Like, looking at the thing we make and like, okay, how do we make this thing more accessible for people who are neurodivergent around the spectrum or whatever, is going on in their life? How do we help them, you know, enjoy the things that we're making, right? So if we have an opportunity somewhere in the conversation, I'd love to add that as well. But with no more ado, all three of our guests have been here before, at least more than once. And so we'll spare you the what's your favorite character. And we'll just jump into introductions. And then please, plug anything you want to plug. We love celebrating our guests and all the cool things that you're doing. So we'll start with Sam.
Hi, I'm Sam DeLove, here to bring down the trajectory of increasing guest quality with my very presence. I'm a role-playing performer, variety streamer, science communicator, and despite public internet rumors, not a goose. That is gander slander. I have played in multiple STA campaigns and have played with a variety of neurodivergent individuals, including one GM. You're on screen with us right now.
All right, thank you, Sam. And I tell you shamelessly, because you're not on the show that often, right? But I would love to get you back more often. But meeting you and Eric and the other folks at that convention, I think it was 2018, is still my singular high point of Gen Con. It was so great to be able to meet you guys. So I'm glad for that. Sorry I missed you this year, but hopefully we'll get a chance to come around again. So yeah. Great segue right into Eric. Why don't you introduce yourself, sir?
Yeah, my name is Eric Campbell. I'm primarily known as a Star Trek GM. I'm mostly known for running Shield of Tomorrow over at Geek & Sundry. And then with Streampunks, the big campaign we ran was Clear Skies. And we've got another campaign coming up, depending on when this comes out. I don't know where we are with that, but yeah.
April 26th.
April 26th. Okay, so we got another campaign coming out. Star Trek has been something that that has been a part of my life. And I was just stars aligned when launching that over at Geek & Sundry. And it's kind of been my thing ever since. And I've been very lucky to help launch the first edition of Star Trek Adventures. And now I'm helping launch the second edition with the show. So it's been a blast. And I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome. Thanks, Eric. And I have to ask you, like, 7 years ago when you were doing the first one with the playtest and then the first edition coming out, did you have any imagination that we would ever get to this place 7 years later, that we'd be doing a launch for second edition?
No, I honestly, I think my biggest fear is that I wouldn't be here. Like I think I was just worried that one of the things after, and Sam can attest to this because they witnessed me going through this, but even as we moved on to other things that we loved, I was always looking over my shoulder, but I'm like, oh man, I gotta get back to Star Trek. Like I gotta get back to that, because it's just my favorite delivery method for stories of hope and optimistic future, and of course the part of me that loves just getting in that master and commander kind of stuff. But I'd always hoped that I could stay connected. And when Streampunk started up, the very first thing we did is we were like, we need to rekindle our relationship with Modiphius, because now that we're independent, we can really like choose our direction. And yeah, we won't have as many like expensive tools at our disposal anymore, but we have the group that everyone is familiar with and stories inside ready to tell. And so it's been exciting. It's thrilling that there's a second edition coming out, because the work from STA first edition to where we are right now has just, it's something that we're constantly talking about when the cameras are off behind the scenes. We're always just talking about how the quality just keeps getting better and better and better and better. Like I remember, I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent right now, but forget.
This show's for you, Eric.
Thanks. Yes, right. But like, yeah, when the Player's Edition and Game Master's Guide came out and the Klingon core book came out, I was like, hey, this game has really evolved and has become really just rich, where it's in the direction that it's going and everything. So when I found out you guys were running a second edition, and I, of course, I got to talk to Samantha Webb, and that was awesome. And her telling me that we were going to be doing this again, I always got a little emotional. It was a nice throwback. It was like, I can only imagine it must have been like a cast member of Trek being asked back to do like, you want to come back and play your character again? That's kind of how it felt. And I was like, yeah, yes.
Awesome. Yeah, well, hopefully we will, we'll do it justice. And then, and when you and the cast get the copies in hand, you'll be able to be very excited all over again. So yeah, that goes. Last but not least, let's introduce our third guest here. Josh, why don't you introduce yourself and carry on.
Thanks, Jim. I'm Josh. This is quite an august panel. I feel very grateful to be on it. I am a writer on Captain's Log, a longtime Star Trek Adventures player. I run a bunch of Star Trek Adventures and other TTRPGs for neurodiverse folks. My peer group, my kids' peer group, my own family, I are very familiar with some of the accessibility issues involved with that. My wife is also someone who works with neurodiverse kids in the school system. So it's something that I've been immersed in. And I think it's something that's really potential of the hobby to really access people and give them a great experience if it's done right. So really excited to talk about this today.
And I'm glad you said that too, because we're airing this, like I said, on April 26th. And one of the reasons we chose April, because it is Autism Awareness Month, which is one spectrum of neurodiversity. And I know I have a family member who is on the spectrum with autism, plays Captain's Log with me. We have fun, my niece. And then I even have somebody at my TTRPG live table who isn't totally comfortable with a lot of words, but we've adapted the game so that he can enjoy the game. And at first he was super nervous. We're now 10 episodes in and he's having a blast and asking to come back constantly. So it works. So again, this is a great month to talk about this and to open up the gates for more people to play. Good. Okay. So with that, let's jump right into it. What are the challenges? What should we be playing? You know, we don't want to exclude people. Well, some people do, but I don't think anybody here is like that. We want to include people as much as possible. So let's talk about some things we should be aware of. Let's jump right into the challenges. Let's start with Josh. You know, you just mentioned that you have, you know, your wife works with those who are neurodivergent. You have some family members who might, you know, have this, what I think is a different way of learning and a different perspective on life. Can you talk to us about that? What are the challenges we should expect?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's such a big topic, maybe almost as a broad outline, you could sort of just picture the scene of someone who's TTRPG curious. You know, maybe they've watched some actual plays. They're really excited about this. They're into Trek. Maybe they've played D&D a little bit. They see this awesome game, Star Trek Adventures. They want to find a local group or a group online and play. And, you know, but fun fact, maybe they're autistic. Maybe they are dyslexic. Maybe they have attention issues. Maybe they're dysgraphic. Maybe they struggle with math in the moment. Maybe they have trouble sitting in a 3-hour session in the same place. Maybe they have Zoom fatigue. Maybe they have social anxiety. And maybe they don't really present with like a high affect like some of the people that role play. And all these things are maybe like places we could double click on, so to speak, and sort of explore, you know, what might help make that experience more accessible to such a person.
Love it. And jump in, you know, Sam, Eric, Jim, what are your addition, you know, add on to that so we can get a full picture of what we're inviting to the game, you know, who we're inviting to the game.
In talking about challenges, Josh has brilliantly identified that we're talking about an incredibly heterogeneous group of people. Neurodivergence encompasses people with ADHD, with autism, with Tourette's, with OCD, with learning disabilities of a bunch of different kinds and a bunch of other developmental conditions. And the needs of not just individuals within each of those subgroups are going to be different because, you know, individual, but what works for one group of neurodivergent people is absolutely not the thing, the 180 of the thing that might work for another individual or for another form of neurodivergence. That when we're talking about this, it's not like there will ever be a one size fits all. And even umbrella approaches toward communicating and establishing needs at the table are going to be different with different neurodivergent people. I will never give a sentence when a paragraph will do, as this response already indicates, but for some neurodivergent people I work with, that page of a wall of text is overwhelming, and that does not work. Whereas with other people, the explicitness of having extensive communication about what's going to make you feel comfortable at the table is a necessary prerequisite. So even as we're trying to establish in this conversation at least some basic principles, some approaches, one of the central challenges is that there's never going to be a prescriptive road to inclusion and to creating a table that is going to work for everybody, because even within a table, you will have something that works for one person and you will have something that absolutely does not work for another person. Access clash or access chafe occurs in all sorts of dimensions of disability. You can have one person who needs a service dog and another person who has an allergy. And these things work likewise.
Great analogy.
Neurodivergence.
Great analogy. And they both deserve to be comfortable and welcome. Exactly. So you have to work with that.
Negotiating those things and finding things that either work as compromises or as individual accommodations for people at the table.
Yeah. Eric, you bring it up a lot on your show. In fact, you have it when, you know, I try to tune in 3 days a week, have you on in the background when I'm working or driving to your Twitch stream, and you advertise it right there, you know, your neurodivergency, ADHD in particular. So talk to us about it. Challenges, what should we be prepared for as we're trying to expand the gaming table?
I mean, my in many ways, my challenges, my personal challenges are classic ADHD challenges. And in fact, I was actually talking to Sam about this last night when I was talking about some of the methods in which I run my games, because when I run my narratives, I'm writing out loud, basically. And my background is acting and screenwriting, and that's segued into storytelling. So running these games is very much, for me, in my brain, writing is acting on paper, And then running these games is doing both for the people in front of me in real time, just basically sketching it in front of folks. And oftentimes, one of the things I have to keep myself in check about when I'm running games and be cognizant of is my inclination to write for them and to write. I was telling Sam, like, the thing that I'm constantly struggling with and have since Shield of Tomorrow and before as a storyteller is to resist the urge to write out what the other character is experiencing and just instead present the stimulus for them to experience on their own. And often I push around on that because my desire is to just, I'm writing the scene in my head, I'm seeing it unfold, and that's, it's a strength and a weakness for sure. That mode of self-awareness has helped me be a lot more cognizant of playing with other players who also have modes in which they engage at the table. Because I do run games for people who are on the autism spectrum, and I do run games for people who are also ADHD like me. Bonnie Gordon, famously, jokingly, she and I go back and forth about this. She likes to joke she's ADHD as hell, because she and I kind of manifest in the same way. We get really passionate about something, we'll bulldoze a conversation. Bonnie does much the same thing, but what's great about Bonnie is she's disciplined herself to put it into a certain format, and it always pulls back the last second before she keeps, you know, kind of going overboard with it. But what I love about it is through Bonnie, I've been able to observe how I engage, and the two of us have learned how to adapt and to run games for that ADHD mind in ways that keep us both very engaged with each other. And it doesn't, we don't overpower the players. And if that does happen, we can spot it, identify it, or make room for when someone's like, hey, so, and we're like, ah, yep, I see what you're talking about. I did that. You're right.
I like that, because, you know, some people call it Autism Acceptance Month. Other people call it Autism Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. Jim, in fact, you've talked about this before. I want to throw it over to Jim. How is Modiphius? I know we've talked about it, but in case people are just tuning in for the first time, how is Modiphius trying to, or not, I won't say Modiphius, you as project manager for Starship Adventures, how are you taking that awareness in how you're building the games, even moving forward like 2E? And I know you had a lot of conversations with Josh about this, designing Captain's Log, and when we were designing Captain's Log. Where's that awareness taking us with how you're project managing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Michael. It's hard for me to speak specifically to neurodivergence and ADHD, because I just don't have the knowledge in my head, right? Like, I'm Gen X. I'm confident I'm on the spectrum somewhere. I've just never been tested. I don't even know where to go to even get tested. And it's like, does it matter? Because, like, I know what I am. I know I'm all over the place, and I can hyper focus on things. And like you were saying, Eric, like, I will absolutely bulldoze a conversation if I have a opportunity to talk about Star Trek or, you know, something that I'm passionate about, right? And in fact, you've seen it on the show plenty of times. I just go, right? And I need Michael to rein me in, or somebody else to rein me in, right? But as a project manager, I think when I took over project managing the line in 2019, right, I was already aware that there's a new generation of gamers and a new generation of Star Trek fans coming into the game and into the franchise, and they do things differently than I did, or even like the millennials or whatever, right? To where they are much more technologically savvy. They want things faster in a lot of ways. I don't mean to paint them with a broad brush, but like in general, I see that they are much more focused on technology. They are much more focused on wanting things quicker. And it, like my son and a lot of his friends, they really thrive on visuals, right? They don't want to look, I mean, my son is a advanced reader, but like he's still 8. Right. So he's still learning how to read. I am not going to hand him a 300 page core rule book and say, OK, here's how to play the game. Let's go. Because that's just not there. Right. And I know that there are adult learners who just cannot absorb pages and pages of text, 2-column text, you know, 10-point text. It's just like it's too much. Right. Even me. Right. Like I read some of our books. I'm like, I can't get through this. This is too much. So like, you know, some writers write, you know, 14 line paragraphs. And like, I can't get through it, right? I just cannot process that much information, which is why I'm grateful for the Kindle, right? Because the Kindle, when I read fiction, I can make the font really big and read like 10 lines at a time. And it just makes it easy to page through it. So anyway, so as a project manager, I've been really focused more on like, how do we make just the books more readable and more accessible? And how do we make the rules a little bit more readable and a little bit more accessible. And it's a real challenge, right? Because I think back to my proposal writing days as a technical writer, where when you're writing a proposal, you always want to have it full of infographics, right? Because a good infographic will tell the story better than 100 lines of text, right? And I learned early on, and I don't have this gift, but I know people who do, that it's a real talent to take a wall of text and turn it into an infographic that somebody can look at and get in like 30 seconds, right?
Josh Allen.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like the stuff you did, Josh, for the game on YouTube and the graphics that you made, like, this is what we need. This is what we need. And the challenge with that is like, it takes time and effort to actually make a good infographic, right? And, this is not an excuse. It's just the reality is that, you know, oftentimes one of our books, like, has a compressed schedule and a compressed budget, and there's only so much we can do in the time and budget that we have, right? And I would love to do more, but just the reality is it's hard to do. But I think with Catherine's log, we made some significant strides in actually making an effort to create some flow charts and some processes to actually make it more readable. And I, you know, spoiler warning, you're going to see that in second edition too. Not as far as I wanted to go, but again, that whole time compression thing really impacted it. Whether this is actually, you know, directly related to, you know, neurodivergence, ADHD, I'm not confident. Like, that's not what we were specifically targeting. I think I was trying to go for more broadly, how do we make this thing more accessible, for everybody, right? Not even getting into like as a game master, how do you make your table more accessible? Yeah, that's a separate topic entirely, which I hope we'll get to a little bit.
Yeah.
Here,
but, yeah, we'll
get stop rambling. So,
no, that's a perfect segue for Josh, actually. I want to hear your take on it because you were so involved with that process.
Well, yeah, I mean, I really appreciated the chance to get some of those infographics into the captain's log. I had made some infographics for the main full game, Star Trek Adventures, and I sort of set this goal in my head that when I ran this game, my personal rule was that my players would never have to read the rule book. And I actually think that's maybe a good culture of play to cultivate if you want to be inclusive at your table, that it should be possible for players to show up and not have digested that rule book, which is a little bit contrary to some of the advice that you will hear out there where they'll say, know the rules, know your character, if that can be condensed. And I think because of the challenges of that project management aspect, Jim, I feel like this is a great opportunity for the fan communities like Continuing Mission and basically YouTube content all over the place that has great introductions to this game, some of it produced by Modiphius, some of it just, you know, fan created, and other resources that you can find. I mean, there's Discord bots. There's, you know, if I don't know if they have these for Star Trek Adventures. I know they have them for Dungeons and Dragons. You can go on Etsy and find great, like, dyslexia friendly character sheets. So it almost like turning to the fan community, I think, can be a really fruitful endeavor if you're trying to really make something accessible.
That sounds fascinating. I haven't seen anything yet on Star Trek Adventures, like dyslexia friendly character sheets. This is my invite to everybody. You know, if you put it out, we'll put it on CM on Continuing Mission. So I would love to see that. Are there any other tools that some of you have employed to make gaming easier and more accessible? Well, we've heard some ideas. That's just so you all know, and I've mentioned it before, the reason I invited Josh and said, you got to meet Jim Johnson, was because I saw what Josh was posting on social media, what he was doing for his kids. And I loved the visual. I got it right away. Not everyone did. And that I'm a visual learner. When I saw it, I knew exactly what the language was happening to me. Plus, I do sign language. So I think his pictures is already how I think, because I've done sign language for 30 years now. And it was just like, boom, I was like, you got to get this guy. He's communicating with me how I want to think. So I'm wondering if, you know, Eric, Sam, Jim, if you've seen anything else that's like, oh man, this is a way to look at the game that helped me absorb it faster. Because I know for a fact that Eric, you invited people in the game who knew none of the rules and you just put the camera on and had them start playing.
Well, yeah, Shield of Tomorrow, that was quite the development process, because we got the alpha version of the rules, so they were still being worked out as we were building them out. And I personally have throughout my entire life struggled with reading large sets of rules that are complex. One of the things, this meme that I came across a few weeks ago on Instagram. There are these great meme communities for ADHD on Instagram, where they add humor to the ADHD experience, which in my experience is one of the best ways to engage, because it really creating a sense of humor and finding a sense of humor about things can be incredibly powerful. And I've enjoyed the hell out of it. And there was a meme about specifically targeting the ADHD mind and how frustrated it gets when it comes across something technical that it doesn't understand. And that's overlapped with like constantly being made to feel like you're stupid growing up, but with folks constantly making you feel like you're not getting it, or and it gets so ingrained that you anticipate walking in the door, you anticipate everyone there is going to assume it the moment you start talking. And because you're going to have to ask them to repeat something, or you're going to have to ask for some kind of accommodation. And there was this meme about it showed the back of a computer and a bunch of wires being plugged into it. And immediately, without even reading the caption, I knew exactly what this meme was. And it's the mind, my brain, and a lot of people I know have ADHD have this experience where when we come across something, sometimes it's almost always when we don't know what we're doing or we've never seen it before, and it smells complex. It looks like it's going to be complex. There is a complete overwhelm shutdown. We go from 0 to 10, and it's an absolute shutdown. And many of us live our lives in that extreme, going from 0 to 10, so much so that a lot of the self-esteem issues that we develop coming from the fact that we feel like we can't do anything with our lives is because it happens so often that we think that's my lot. I'm never going to amount to anything. I go from 0 to 10. Like, I can't do basics. I can't fold my damn laundry. And that, like, how am I going to find a partner if I can't even fold my damn laundry? Kind of stuff like that. You know what I mean? And Star Trek Adventures and learning any system with any kind of that level of complexity and dynamics. When we first started learning for Shield of Tomorrow, I was the one that had the problem first. Because I was the captain of that ship. Like, I had to get everyone prepped for the rules. I had to produce it and develop it with Geek & Sundry. I had to get all the assets in place. I was coordinating with Paramount CBS. We were trying to build the sets. I had to learn the rules. And I had to learn the rules so that I could make the rules feel less intimidating for other people like Bonnie, who have ADHD. Bonnie is there for performance and character explanation. Bonnie is not there for rules. Does not want to show up for rules. That's just their flavor of the game experience. Same with Hector Navarro. Like, Hector is just there because he wants to freaking be in Star Trek. And that's where I want people to start.
Yeah, imagine. And I want to say to that, imagine if we would have lost them because we demanded that they learn the rules like we do or something. Imagine what we would have lost in artistry with that.
Yeah. And there's a lot. And what's curious about Star Trek, though, it's multi-layered because it's not just the rules. It's the lore. There's a lot of folks that feel like, oh, yeah, no, I don't know what an inertial dampener is. That's my favorite thing to go to, because in the early days of Shield of Tomorrow, they didn't stick around very long, thankfully, but we did have some fans that got a little toxic in the beginning, and they were trying to, we called them Trek checking us. And we're like throwing lore. There's all these moments where the writing in Star Trek contradicts each other. And they had the audacity to come in and tell us, no, it's this way. And we're like, I have 6 episodes that say it's not. So stuff like that. It's just really interesting. And I'm so distracted right now because someone's knocking at my door.
It's okay. We got go answer to your.
I'm going to go answer and find out who's knocking at my door.
That's probably good. No, and this will be a good. Sam, did you want to add anything to that before?
Yeah, no, while my GM is out of earshot, I have an opportunity. No, but seriously, Eric brought up a great point about internalizing shame and self-esteem issues associated with being neurodivergent. Before someone neurodivergent arrives at your table, they have as much backstory as their character. With that, people will arrive there at your table and they'll have had a history of what expectations they feel they haven't met. And so even if you want to create an inclusive table, it's important to be aware of, to acknowledge and to honor that a lot of people are coming with a history of shame or feelings of inadequacy that will project onto you even if you know internally, I'm not like that. I'm going to be an inclusive person at this table. That's not something that someone's going to mind read about you. That's something that has to be proactively demonstrated and communicated, especially if someone hasn't necessarily disclosed their neurodivergence to you or even thought of asking for accommodations that they need. As a Wheeler, I never get the sense from people that I should feel ashamed for asking for accommodations. And yet, when I have to ask for accommodations with sensory processing, as Eric has encountered playing music and other sounds at the table, that hits differently and is a common experience to a lot of folks.
I love that you say that because, in pure humility, whenever I'm in this situation, I'm like, okay, let me watch people just to give a little background in real life and then in the game, just so I want people to understand this who are listening to this and be like, okay, well, I do have a friend who has a learning disability. And because of that, maybe I've been hesitant to invite them to the game. Or somebody says, nowadays with kids, you have five kids, you're going to have one or two of them who are going to have some sort of neurodivergency going on. They need to be included in the game, right? How are we adapting for them? So at work, many of you know, I do organizational development. So that's all the learning and putting together the events for the group. And we have neurodiversity on our checklist when we're putting together even an employee appreciation event. Is it accessible physically, but it is also accessible neurodivergency? So yeah, there's some people who want to be clubbing and sitting over there by the band, but we need to actually, on the other hand, have some pool tables and some Jenga and some quiet activity, and we build the full spectrum. Some people want to be on a video game by themselves. Other people want to do bubble soccer. And so we build this huge complex. We use this complex and we have tried to get the whole spectrum, and we get rated really high for our events because we're building for all the different types of sensory opportunities that people want or don't want. In the game, I was a learning opportunity for me around that TTRPG when we visited my friend who, again, told me that they're autistic on the spectrum and don't like to read a lot. What amazed me and what humbled me was that even though they said that, but after the first game, they had taken 2 pages of thorough notes. In my mind, I was like, wait a second, if you don't like to read a lot, then you don't like to write a lot. Oops, learning experience for me. And I still have those notes and we keep them. And every time he comes, he refers to them because I guess they work for him. So he's basically rewriting the rules in his own on paper for himself. And so to me, that was humbling. To your point, Sam, is we cannot make assumptions about what their needs are. How do we open it up and have the discussion while still dignifying people?
Because you're going to have folks in the same way. I know if I ask people to repeat themselves and then I still didn't hear them, every so often I will just fake like I understood and try to make do. And analogously, a lot of people go through life thinking that they don't need accommodations. And one of the most important things we can do at our tables is try to lower the threshold to ask for something that genuinely, when every other aspect of your life involves trying the expectation that you will conform to a vessel that is not shaped for you, the expectation won't be that the table will be any different. And so just setting from the beginning that it's okay. And not just to say that with it's okay, ask something in this really open-ended way that so rarely is any of us comfortable taking up, but proactively with examples. If you need to take a break, that's okay. If you need to ask for repetition or for additional resources or for clarification or giving enough examples to ideally communicate not just that any specific accommodation is okay, but that the bar we have for asking for things is low enough and that it's not a thing to feel ashamed about. It's just something you can ask for because people are different, have different needs, and we're not coming in here with the expectation that you have to conform yourself to the vessel.
Yeah, and I go ahead, Jim.
Oh, no, I was just going to, I was going to say, it shows you how important the role of game master is in a game, right? Because you're not just running the game. You're setting the tone for the whole table. You're presenting the kind of game that you want to play, and that you're embracing Itik, and you're embracing everybody, and you're trying to accommodate everybody, and you're trying to be thoughtful and patient and hopefully leading by example, right? By asking for things and then inviting other people to ask for things as well. The question I had for everybody is like, okay, so you're a game master, and we've all got game master experience, obviously. Like, how do you prepare for that? Right. Like, are you talking to people over email ahead of time saying, hey, I'm going to run this game. Here's things that you should be aware of. Maybe you're running a game at a convention and you don't know anybody at the table. How do you set the stage for people to be open and inviting and to be willing to be vulnerable? Right. Because clearly we've all had that shame experience where we're really super self-conscious and maybe don't want to bring our full selves to the table because we're confident that we're going to get, maybe not intentionally smacked down for it, but like in our head, like certainly me, I've got a lot of social anxiety. Like I'm confident that, if I can sit back and be the introvert and just listen and not open my mouth and risk myself, I'll do that. But, I'm just curious, just whoever wants to answer, like, how do you make your table inviting, whether it's a group of people that you know really well, or it's a new group of people that you're bringing into the table?
Okay, I'll start. Oh, Josh, go ahead. You go.
Oh, no. Sure. I don't personally have experience running convention games, so I'm not familiar with that sort of cold, strangers in from the cold type play. I really prefer a long warming process for the game. I love to make a slide deck that sort of sets out the vision for the game, and I can incorporate, people's feedback about what they want out of the game. I think it is possible to do this thing that I think we're all pointing towards, like Sam, like you said, the big umbrella, where, in a video game, we can each have settings of what we're opting into in that game. And I think we can create that at our table too. This person wants peril and is okay if their character dies. That's what they're getting thrilled by. This other player just will leave the table if their character dies. And that's totally fine. And I'm literally creating different rules for them. This player wants to dramatically roleplay everything. This other player basically just wants to rely on the rules and does not want, they want to be an introvert playing an extrovert. They want to be, someone who struggles with word choices in the moment playing a charmer. And so we can arrange all this and just set expectations and sort of establish that tone. So I basically just a really long session zero with some write-ups I found is really helpful.
Yeah, I've ran convention games and I of course run classes and with a lot of different people, even language is a second language. And one of the first things I assess early on is how do you like to absorb information? And I do that with a couple of outset activities to read the room. I even watch where people sit in the room initially to kind of gauge, okay, that's how engaged they're ready to be for whatever reason. They're at the back. Why are they trying to hide? Are they not comfortable? So I do kind of those kind of exercises. And I know when I did the game at Gen Con this last time, just being aware of that, when I sat down, one of the first questions I asked people was like, how do you like absorb information? Like when I explain something, do you like it visually? Because I brought pens and stuff. I have index cards. Do you like it verbally? Are you all into moving around? I kind of asked that AVK question, audiovisual kinesthetic question, because I didn't want to overwhelm anyone. And to your point, Jim, that you were talking about, I'm big on dignity. Like, I don't care who is on this planet. You have to dignify everyone. That's the only way to work. And so I'm really extra conscious because when Sam was talking, one of the things I wrote down is that how can someone who's not comfortable in their own body go play someone else in another body? And that's kind of how I think about role playing. It's like, how do you get them to be comfortable? And sometimes they may have to come in and be a little bit of themselves and be accepted in that environment to open up to other characters and grow and be like, wow, this is a really safe environment for me. I can do that. I can run if I want to. Can I not do anything and just stand and watch? Yes, you can. That is perfectly acceptable. Yeah. And so I think those are things we have to think of when I'm thinking of this in learning and development and inviting more people to the table. GM does have to do a I want to say a good GM. A GM who wants to expand their table to this level needs to have some of these best practices in mind.
And,
No, go ahead.
Well, because we're talking a lot about what a GM can do for a table on the assumption, false in my case, that we all GM here. But an assumption that's baked into that is belied by this very panel, to wit, that the neurodivergence is on the player side. And that the GM is the locus of accommodation and has to, if they have neurodivergence, I don't know, just kind of, I don't know, stuff that in a cubbyhole or something. But that's not how any of this works. And accommodating our GMs as players is also a thing that is important to creating an inclusive table, because not just for the player who might want a GM someday, but to deny ourselves neurodivergent GMs at the height of their powers is a disservice, let me tell you, because when your GM's comfy, they thrive, and then they threaten you. And that's what we players all end up with, you know, leaking a warp core. But Eric, I know you probably have a lot to say about accommodating neurodivergent players, but I would also really love to hear from you about what helps you as a GM to be accommodated at the table.
It's fascinating because so it's a tricky subject to talk about because it gets so personal. So much of the experience of being somebody with ADHD and running games, this is a phenomenon that's only really been starting to be discussed. From what I understand, it's not officially part of any medical journals, but there's enough that therapists and whatnot are talking about it because it surfaces so often, and it seems to present specifically often with people with ADHD is the idea of rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is something that gets talked about a lot. And it's a concept that's really starting to get pushed around because so many of us have that experience. And, you know, for me personally, it is absolutely lovely when you have players that are accommodating you at the table. For me personally, what it really comes down to is that if I feel like I can't get my players to stop looking at their phones or to pay attention to what's happening in the game, I am so perceptive. I don't mind saying that. When it comes to me sitting at the center of the table watching all my players, I'm always gauging what everyone's emotional state is so that I can direct a scene immediately over to like a quick camera pan. Because everything I do, my brain works. Growing up on movies, I see things in that cinematic profile of like the camera pan, the quick snap cuts, stuff like that. I mean, Sam used to make fun of me and then like the lighthearted nature, because one of my favorite things is like a bad edit was one of my favorite descriptions of like suddenly something just happens and it just clicks into place. And for me, it's tricky because it takes so much work for my ADHD brain to sit down and prepare a game, probably twice as hard for most typical brains. And when you show up and you have poured your soul into it and a player calls out last minute or somebody's not paying attention to the table, your brain immediately goes into, why am I here? What am I doing? They don't care. I need to quit. My heyday was at GNS. I need to put this down and walk away now. it's impossible to turn the anxiety brain off. What I've learned to deal with it is two things. Is one, I've learned that's just never going to stop. That's part of the experience. Just go with it, but just don't buy into it. It can have a voice and it can talk, but you're not going to buy into it. And the second part, and probably the most important part, is having a player that will support the GM, because oftentimes players will forget the GM is a player at the table. And it's a dynamic, particularly in this age of streaming TTRPGs, because of the dynamics as they have grown around shows and show formatted things. It typically, like, GMs will get viewed as the captain of the ship because they're the ones running the game. I will tell you that I don't see myself that way as a GM. I definitely see that way with Streampunk stuff because I'm producing it as well. So that's different. When I'm the producer, I take the producer hat. That is different. But like running the game, yeah. When you have players that can support you, can see where you're going. Like Sam and I have been playing together long enough now where it's like they know exactly what beats I'm going for. They know when I'm trying to wrap it up. They know when I'm trying to move on. They know when I'm about to drop the hammer. They know the beats. They can sense it. And if they feel like the group is lagging or like stumbling over something or getting hung up on it or doing the classic player conundrum of talking in circles for, you know,
okay, but where, Eric, I want to scan this. Can I scan this?
Yeah. And like, and that kind of thing. Sam has been really good because Sam sees how I flow in a game and can realign the group to sync back up with me as a GM. And Sam's not the only one. Some of the other players are actually starting to catch on to it too. And I've noticed that, and it's really handy. And every now and then, and I love her to death because the experience of running games for Bonnie is just, it's so familiar. Like I'll have moments where I'm in the flow and I'm like it happened in the Lord X one shot. I'm wrapping up the game. It's like the seventh time Bonnie has done this. Like I'm wrapping up the game and I'm trying to bring the curtain down because we have a hard out and Bonnie's like, wait, and goes into a narrative like right there. I have done that myself so many times. You can't help it. You got something you got to say. You got a creative thing. Like you, nothing. Hell or high water is not going to stop you from doing it. And I've learned to find the humor in it. And also Bonnie just gives us gold all the time. So that is Bonnie's able to sort of, I can accommodate Bonnie. Sam accommodates me. We have this great like synergy that just bounces around the table. And when your foundation is to take care of other people at the table, you will be amazed at the depth and complexity of story that can take place when there is that bond of trust with people at the table, the ability to trust fall into story, you will come up with stuff you would never have thought up when you sat down to write up the adventure.
Yeah. And that's the segue I actually want to go into, because we talked about the challenges, but I actually want to talk about the blessings now, because all of us have played or seen people play who, you know, maybe are neurodivergent, have learning disabilities or stuff like that. And I do want to get into the richness of the blessings. Maybe Josh, we could have you start, because, you know, one of my favorite things is getting new players into the genre, and Josh is over there getting kids and teenagers and teaching them and spawning more Star Trek adventure fans and D&D. I know he plays quite a few, but right. So Josh, maybe talk to us. What are some of the blessings and why is it worth taking this journey and expanding our tables in this fashion?
I mean, where to begin? I mean, the hobby is just so fantastic for social skills development and also growth. I mean, I feel like, you know, it is a performance, and you can watch the actual plays like Shield of Tomorrow. You can really like the high quality of what's going on there. But then you want to take your baby steps, and you're here in this really safe space with your friends, hopefully. And, you know, if everybody is pulling towards this goal, like everybody's been talking about, you really have a safe place to push yourself in a way that is, you know, away from an audition or the public eye. It's just for you and your friends at the table. So it's almost, sometimes I call it like slow media, because it's sort of like slow food. Like you're cooking this stuff up, you're making this meal just for yourselves. And it's almost a indulgence of your time and effort, but it's just for the best reasons and the best outcomes. So I think that, you know, just, you know, and I talked a little bit earlier about, can an introvert play an extrovert? And I think this is actually where, if you have that mix, you know, like I personally, the way I work is I'm a total introvert, but then I have these sort of extrovert curious moments and I push myself and then I get absolutely exhausted. And it basically happens every time I run a game. And I so relate to what Sam and Eric were just talking about, where after I've run a live table, I'm just like, it's like I just gave a sales pitch for this major account. And it's like, I'm just absolutely drained. Like I need a drink, you know? But I think that the table can actually be that place where you grow towards the things that you want to do, you know, in baby steps, like I said. So I think there's so much potential there.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, if you look throughout human history too, storytelling has been one of the most powerful ways to transmit information, not some sort of didactic Oxford learning, which we've been molded into in Western culture. And so to me, the freedom that comes from watching, say, my niece, who is super awkward in a room, and she's slowly, I don't know if she's growing out of it or she's growing into it, you know, I don't want to say it like that. Because at home, she's comfortable, can talk. We have these amazing stories. We crack up laughing. I understand her. I let her go off like she must be the Bonnie for me. But watching her then now be able to role play, because, you know, they talk about code switching and whatever you want to call it, go into different things. She's 16 years old, going to parties now, and be able to, like, I can role play this. And she said that one day, and I was like, oh. I was like, it became a tool. You've learned that sometimes in different environments, you have to adapt. And to me, that was just like, That's all I have as not an expert on the subject could say, like, wow, there it is. And maybe I think all of us here who've role played or do most of our teen years have actually fell back on it at work and in other areas of life, all the tools we learn, the social skills that Josh mentioned, right?
For me, it's very specific because my approach to the whole experience is from an acting point of view. I a lot of what I do as a GM is really linked to my experience learning. There's a very specific way that I've learned acting. My mentor is a man named Steven Anderson, who's been out in Los Angeles and got his start like on Three's Company and working Wonder Woman and all the way up through, was actually in an episode of TNG, a very famous episode of TNG, where you'll remember it. It was the episode where Riker had been injured on a first contact mission and he was in a hospital and the crew was trying to rescue him and he was being aided in the escape and that woman wouldn't let him escape unless he made love to her. And he's like, I don't even know. Like, of course, because it's Riker, right? So, Steven's in that episode. He's one of the alien doctors. Steven had a very unique approach. So before I even got into running games professionally, back when I was still pursuing acting full time and writing at home, Steven's approach was very much based on this idea, this principle of really just play. At the end of a scene, he would never say, okay, let's find out what was wrong with the scene or what do you think we could tweak? Steven's approach would always be when a scene would wrap, he would be, okay, so what was your experience? And it was never what's wrong. It's what's missing. And Steven's adaptation to scene work, I started becoming clear to me that what he was doing is he was removing judgment from the creative process and he was getting rid of that. And the focus on play, taking us back to when we were kids at the playground and we didn't care how stupid we thought we looked. In fact, the sillier, the better. The louder your T-Rex can be, the better. You know, whatever you're doing, that fundamental aspect of that, each of us has had that experience of finding that moment as children when, you know, our G.I. Joes were battling for the fate of the world. And those little bitty moments, those Calvin and Hobbes moments, they're not gone. And what attracted me to TTRPG and bringing that aspect into what I do created what became for me a scenario of salvation for a mind that was so critical of itself and judgmental towards itself for how it operated. When all of a sudden you are creating an arena here where you're bringing people together, maybe many who have forgotten what it was like to pick up an action figure when they were a kid or told it was silly, or maybe they haven't really gotten a chance to experience the liberation of looking silly and ridiculous and remember how much fun that was, and sit them down and create the form. You're on a starship. What's your character like? Tell me what their favorite food is. Do they have opinions towards replicated food? Like things like that. Just asking some basic questions and getting into the what if, what if, what if, tell me more, what if. And that synchronicity of bouncing the ideas off, I find at its most fundamental level, role-playing, TTRPG is a great delivery method for this, but role-playing is one of the purest forms of play. because we are working together in an activity that inevitably builds bond between pack mates, between social structures, between, like, I'm talking from like lion cubs to like proto humans and the back in the day, like that has been one of the fundamental aspects that teaches survival, community, instinct, speed, all of the stuff that we develop and learn. And being able to go back and use things like Trek and these fantastical worlds of what if and whatnot, and engaging with that. If you start at that fundamental level, you're making games accessible to everyone. We've all been there. We've all closed our eyes and thought about it. We've all read the books. We've all wondered what it would be like in zero G. We've all had those experiences. And all you got to do is just sit down at the table and realize that what you're doing is celebrating play.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, Eric, every time I talk to you or have a panel with you or listen to you on your Twitch or something, I hear something new that's like, oh yeah, we have a shared experience. Theater is so powerful, and I'm resonating, like everything you all are saying is resonating completely with me. Like where I am like an off scale introvert, right? Like in a social situation, I'm over in the corner. I'm listening to everything, and I'm engaged and actively listening. But like for me to participate, no way. But one of the things I had to learn, both in the corporate world and then just, you know, socially, was that, and this is how theater helped me, like auditioning for plays and getting into plays, whether it was, you know, the third spear chucker from the left or actually a, you know, character role or something, is that when I was in social situations, somewhere along the way, I don't know if I learned this from somebody or if I just kind of like, if it just happened, but it was like, oh, wait, I can go into this situation and role play. I can be a character. I don't have to be me. Cause like I'm super self-conscious and like, I'm always terrified of looking stupid. Right. So, but if I'm playing a different character who doesn't care about that, then I can go into this social situation and role play it and be something different. And then I feel good. Right. Like, and if I'm doing a show, like it's not me, it's the character. Right. And I'm much more confident on stage because I'm doing a performance and the script is written for me. Right. What a blessing that is. I don't have to think about what I'm saying. It's like, oh, it's all there on the page for me. I don't have to worry about it. I can just be this character, right? I just love how that ties into role playing because something you said earlier, Eric, was that you know, as a game master, it's not about me. It's about me facilitating an awesome game experience for everybody at the table because I want them to be awesome, right? Like when I've got players at the table, I want to throw just enough information to them that they can grab those seeds and go off and running with it and make an amazing story. And then like, if I'm able to sit back and put myself on mute and just listen to them role play and play the game as they're going, and maybe I'll give them a little nudge with a game master character or just a little situation or something, like being able to sit back and just watch them be amazing is the biggest fulfillment for me. And there is not another, well, a theater's close, right? Because in theater, especially community theater, and actually I'm sure it's true for professionals too, right? You are hyper-focused on a creative thing for a short period of time, and you have an amazing bond with your cast and crew for 10 weeks, 12 weeks, however long it is, and then it ends. But like that flow state where you all get into the flow state together and you all know you're driving toward creating this amazing thing, and then it goes up and then, you know, it's amazing and you're done. We get to do that every week in an RPG, right? Every single week, we get to make a new thing every week. And it's amazing when you're able to get the right group of people together that are vibing off each other and connecting with each other. And like you were saying, you and Sam were saying, where you pick up on each other's tendencies and like, you know, where you're going, you know, mm-hmm. where you want the scene to go. That's cash money right there. And it's even a bonus that is Star Trek, right? We've watched right. 800 episodes of Star Trek. We know the beats. We know the feel of Star Trek, right? And it's not something you can teach, right? I could write, you know, 10,000 pages in a RPG book to try to get it. Like, how do I teach mm-hmm. this to somebody? And you just can't do it. You just have to learn by doing, I think.
Yeah. The last thing I just wanted to add, because you said something I just wanted to touch on, but this was one of the things that helped me with ADHD and anxiety in particular. A lot of people don't know this, but if you go back and watch Shield of Tomorrow, I had my very first panic attack ever live on air on Shield of Tomorrow. I didn't know what was happening to me, and it was terrifying. And the episode is still up. You can go watch it happen. And I was using all my theater training to keep my cool and pretend like everything was okay. I thought I was about to pass out, so I dropped a bottle cap head on the floor to act like I needed to pick it up so that I could put my head between my knees. And I stayed there for a second, and it wasn't working. I didn't know what was going to happen. So Sam remembers, I'll be right back. I forgot something in my desk, and I walked off camera, and I walked about 10 feet, and I dropped to my knees and fell down on the set that we ended up shooting Callisto 6. And they had to keep going because it was live. And the audience started catching on something was up. My first panic attacks started happening, and it was terrifying. And I had one again. Second one was the very final episode of Shield of Tomorrow. There was a moment where I thought I was about to black out, and I couldn't figure out what was causing them. But I started using a tool for anxiety and whatnot when it comes to running games, based off of something that you said real quick, Jim. And this was a tool that, again, my mentor, Steven, who ran this acting class, because he worked with all kinds of people. He worked from everybody who were also neurodivergent to WWF wrestlers. Or WWE wrestlers. And he had this great tool that he just, like, a fun little tool that he would do. And the tool was, don't tell anybody, but when you sit down for the game session or an acting, don't tell them, to never tell them, but decide, pick someone and dedicate the game to them that night. It doesn't mean you have to focus on them, but you can say, you know what, this one's for Gina. Tonight I'm dedicating this game to Gina, and just secretly doing that. And the thing is it moves the focus outside yourself. It is like moving, it's manipulating your attention. It's suggesting and moving your attention away from the recursive screaming that's going on inside your head when you're going into an anxiety attack. And that's just a thing that I have used to go into to dealing with some of my neurodivergent behaviors and whatnot, is if I can dedicate it or do something about that, I'll get out of that thinking mindset, and it makes it a little easier for me to access my players and them to access me. It's just a fun tool that I use. May not work for everybody, but I've discovered that it works really great for me.
I'm borrowing that. I know people would never believe it. I actually have horrible fear of public speaking, like, which is why I like Zoom, because I feel like I'm in my little safe zone. But I have to go it, and I've gone to therapy for public speaking. And honestly, what you just said, I really shift the spotlight to, I want the audience just to have the best time ever. And how can I totally spotlight because otherwise I feel like there's a spotlight on me all the time, and that kills me. So I literally, in my mind, I picture myself turning the spotlight, which is probably why I like continuing missions, because it's all about celebrating the fans and I don't have to think about it.
You know, it's so funny you said that too. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to say one thing, because this absolutely clicks into the neurodivergence thing. And it's something I've talked about a lot on my channel, and I've stumbled over it a whole lot because it's difficult to explain it to people. As somebody with ADHD, it has been incredibly difficult switching to remote play for my brain, because so much of what I do is acting based, is theatrical based. And so much of what drives and propels my storytelling and what I do was when we were able to play in person, and we still can't right now, because some of us, myself included, have risk factors involved when it comes to COVID. And even though it's gotten better, it ain't gone. And we have to abide by the fact that it's still out there. And it's been about 4 years now, I guess. And on Zoom, it is, and we don't, it's had its perks, because thank God I get to play with Noir and Anita, and I get to play with so many people out there that we adore, like Caitlin. Like, I think of a world without Noir, Anita, and Caitlin, and I'm like, I don't like that version of Stream Punks. I want them. So I wouldn't have gotten it if we hadn't gone remote. But yeah. But that's weighed against the fact that adjusting to Zoom play every single time, it never fails. Every single session for the past 4 years is a challenge for me. It's always hard. It's harder. It's not, and it sucks, because when I end a session, no matter how good the session went, I end it knowing that was not my best work. Like, I just, because my brain doesn't, it hasn't adjusted. It's complicated. It's difficult to describe why I can't do that. And it took a long time to actually be totally okay with it and just be like, it doesn't have to be your best. You can't be your own audience. Yeah. So when the camera ends and I say that wasn't my best work, that's not for me to say.
Yeah, I think that's the irony of it is everyone views you and your show as the number one leader in Star Trek Adventures.
Oh, God.
It's like, it's just so funny. It's so ironic.
I appreciate that. Everyone asks about that. And I'm just like, I swear to God, it's just all it is supplying room for your players to just go at it and just be players. And then they make you look really good. That's the secret.
Yep. So let's do this. Let's have one last go around right before gratitude. It doesn't have to, we've talked a lot about it. Again, I want to explain that, April is Autism Acceptance or Awareness Month, however you regard it. In my final word, and then we'll take it around, is I remember one time I was at a game shop called Game Castle here in the Bay Area. And we were playing board games and someone sat down who was on the spectrum nonverbal. And the mom was so nervous because he was obviously interested in the game. He probably was like maybe 19, 20 years old or something. And we were like, sit down, come play with us. And she kind of jumped in, and be like, oh, no. I was like, no, he can roll the dice. And he got to play with us. And to me, that's kind of like that kind of feeling is what I want to create in every game as much as possible. We know, yes, sometimes we want to play very advanced level RPGs. That's fine. That's cool. If you want that just to be your niche for the rest of your life, go at it. But if you do want to expand and give people new experiences so that they like gaming from different angles, that's why we wanted to cover this topic tonight. It is a great feeling when you let someone, even if it's just roll the dice, play with you, it changes your life for sure. Let's go final words on that, on this subject, and then we'll do our gratitude. Eric, Sam, Josh, Jim.
I'd like to say that very often we've talked here a lot about assumptions of neurotypicality at the table, but I also want to challenge the assumption of neurotypicality in TTRPG as a whole. We talk about including neurodivergent people. Realistically, look at this hobby. It is the neurotypical people who are beneficently being included. That this hobby has always had neurodivergent people and in a lot of ways has been built by and for neurodivergent people. That there are neurodivergent people who bathe in the complexity of a rule set and pouring hours into finding those interactions of optimization, or people who will give you those extensive backstories because they can't stop thinking about it, that this hobby has always been neurodivergent at its core. And if anything, the inclusion is about stripping away the neurotypical normativity that we bring to every other aspect of our lives and making it clear that that's not how this hobby should work, that a lot of us bring a lot of baggage with us to that effect. But really, when this hobby is at its best, when Trek is at its best, is in accepting as a fundamental premise IDIC and that we build from that. This is not some inclusion that dilutes what this hobby is in some way, or that you need to have some training wheels version of TTRPG. No, there's way too much and way too diverse TTRPG for that ever to have been the case. There, regardless of what flavor of neurodivergent you are, there is a place in TTRPGs for you.
I feel sorry for everyone who has to follow you after this. That was so well said.
I guess it is going to be me. I was like, nope, I'm not doing it.
This.
I'm hearing the clock tick. I'm like, what else could I say about this? Honestly, you wouldn't realize it, but it did change your life when you started doing this. Even if it is somebody at the table you just met who handed you a pair of dice one day, And now you're in your 30s and you remember back to that time in the Bay Area where you went to the store and your mom nervously let you sit down at a table and somebody was kind enough to hand you a pair of dice. Now you're designing the next big board game. Like things like that, it really is. I know it might sound melodramatic, but I have seen the effects that gaming has had on me as an individual and learning empathy and learning how to communicate and learning how to create worlds with people. And when it comes to neurodivergence and in gaming, one of the big things that I learned from gaming, and this is a little vulnerable of me to say, but the big realization that I had was I had never heard anybody refer to ADHD as a disability before. And when that person said that to me, it felt so outrageously validating, so utterly, incredibly validating. I thought it was a glitch in the matrix. and it never occurred to me. And so that wouldn't have happened had it not been for gaming, because that person is in this chat right now with us. And it was a life-changing moment, a very subtle, very soft-spoken, very kind of quietly delivered moment that maybe would have passed anybody else by, but it never escapes me now. And there is so much I've learned about ADHD and celebrated about my ADHD, because there are so many things about it that I can do stuff that a lot of people are like, how the hell did you do that? And I don't know. My brain's wired that way. So it's a great tool to teach, to get you to practice non-judgment. And when you can do that, it opens up all the doors, go flying open and possibility. So that would probably be my last statement on the subject.
Wonderful. Josh, and then Jim?
I mean, straight facts from Sam and Eric here, how to follow those. I guess I would just embellish a little bit some of what both of you have been talking about in that sense of play that this can cultivate, but also that the depth of, you know, the sort of this is too reductive, but the neurodiverse attraction to TRPGs and making the hobby what it is, it's worth acknowledging that the hobby is more than what happens at the table. I mean, when I think about myself and my what is challenging for me, what is relaxing for me, how would I want to spend some of my free time? Well, I'd like to draw pictures. I'm not very good. I'd like to make maps. It's really relaxing. I'd like to paint miniatures. I'm terrible at it, but it's really like almost ASMR for me. I would like to do some creative writing. I just like write random stuff, small bits. I could do all those things, but TTRPG sort of gives you a reason to do that. And sometimes maybe the table is just this place where you come together and this inner life that you're really able to pursue in the way that really stimulates you in that calm state of flow is what it creates outside in the rest of your life. And I think that's another blessing for folks who are wired that way in this hobby.
Well said, Jim.
I have to follow all of this. Oh my God. what can I say?
Glad I went first.
Yeah. We're going to have to change that up someday. I'll let you go last next time. Josh brought up a great point about how open and accepting the hobby is, right? And speaking specifically of Star Trek, like I've gone to plenty of conventions, and there is no other place in the world that I can think of where I've gone to that wasn't more. Am I get that right? Like Star Trek conventions are the most open and welcoming place I've ever been to. Like no matter which, I've been to probably 100 conventions, like all around the country, and like every single one of them was like, "Oh, you're a fan of whatever, and you want to wear a costume from whatever, sure, come on in. You're welcome. We got the filkers over here. We got the cosplayers over here. We got all this other stuff. We're cross genres. We're cross IPs. Like there's all kinds of stuff. Like everybody absolutely was welcome, and there was no judgment, right? And that is such a rarity in this world to have that lack of judgment happening at a convention. It's like I could walk around the halls at 2 o'clock in the morning in a toga and somebody be like, oh yeah, totally cool. You fit right in. I think maybe actually, you know what? The only other place I can think of that has been quite that open has been a Renaissance festival, like a Renaissance fair. I think those are like Renaissance fairs and Star Trek conventions. There's gotta be a Venn diagram of an overlap there somewhere. I'm confident. But anyway, just the hobby is amazing. And if you are blessed, like I've been blessed, to have an amazing group of players to play with consistently, to where you're able to get together with them and make magic week in, week out, month in, month out, like whatever your cadence is, right? Whatever your schedule is. Maybe you can only meet once a month. Maybe you only meet a couple times a year or something. It's an incredible hobby. And I want to do everything I can to help enable other people to get into it one way or another. And it's always been a challenge. You know, neurodivergence, you know, all this stuff aside, you know, part of that's important, you know, obviously, but like, how do we get more people involved? How do we get more people in? No matter what game you're playing, you don't have to be playing Star Trek Adventures. You could play literally any of the millions of RPGs that are out there, right? I'm sure there's with the indie scene happening, I'm sure there's got to be a million RPGs out there now, or some flavors of them. So I would also encourage people, you know, go audition for a show, go scratch the theater itch, because you will learn so much as a writer and as an actor and as an RPGer just from doing one audition. Like you'll just learn so much. It's just amazing. But yeah, I'm not going to be eloquent as these other folks have been. So
your heart felt
there.
Your heart felt. That's more important than eloquent.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. So with that, you know, we'll keep our gratitudes a little brief today going around. I'm actually going to give my gratitude to something some of you may not have heard of before. It's CPTD. It's a certification for professional development. It's ATD, the Association for Talent Development. And I have to thank them because that was a certification I took, and it taught me about multiple intelligences, the different way people want to learn, and creating a global workspace. And these are things, what's funny is I had done through RPG, not knowing what we were doing with RPG, to your point, you know, Sam, is about, it's our culture to make it inclusive. And then later on, I got certification. I was able to put a label on, oh, that's the science behind it. Cause I love neuroscience, you know, in organizational psychology, you got to. I'm going to give a shout out to organizations like that, who are educating us so that we can be more effective human beings. If anybody has a chance to learn about neuroscience or conflict resolution, dive into it. Sometimes people ignore that at work, thinking the technical skills are more important. I disagree. People skills are top. Technical skills, you know, are technical skills. So I'm going to thank ATD on that one. Sam, we'll pass it to you for your gratitude.
Absolutely. Because this is a panel about inclusion and neurodivergence, I would be remiss if I did not extend my gratitude to the many disabled activists and thinkers who gave me the foundation of how I think about and talk about these issues. People like Alice Shepard, Stella Young, Alice Wong, William Peace, Velissa Thompson, Essie Smith, Lydia Brown, Finn Gardner, Mia Mingus. That's just a tiny, off the top of my head, people who have particularly influenced me. And I'm so grateful they have made me the disabled person I am today. I'm so much better for it. And I hope that people who are interested in learning about neurodivergence and inclusion look at those activists, many others in neurodivergent activist spaces and in disability activism spaces as a whole, because the cross-pollination between these ideas has been so valuable to me, and I'm so grateful for it.
Thank you, Josh.
I'll express my gratitude for therapists, basically. And with particular mind to, I've just been so amazed and impressed at the intersection that seems increasing in my view between therapy and creative endeavors. There are so many play-based therapies, like for kids. There are so many gaming adjacent therapies, MFTs that are game masters, like the ones that were on a previous panel that we talked about, that I just think that it's a great space that some of the sense of returning to some of the ways you felt in childhood that Eric has talked about. I think that there's some really progressive, really inclusive therapists in the current generation that are helping people understand themselves and understand their needs so much better than in the past. It's really inspiring.
I love that. I love that. All right, let's go, Eric, and then Jim, you'll send us off.
I guess mine is I keep thinking about the educators that I was in spec ed for pretty much my entire career as a student, and there was really not a very wide understanding of ADHD back then, and they had me written up as having learning disability, and they put me in what they called level 5 observations, so that I always had a teacher leaning over my shoulder and trying to walk me through it, and it always sounded very sort of dystopian on paper, I guess. But the truth of the matter was, is that I was working with people who wanted to understand and who were working with me and being patient with me and finding out the things that they could do, the carrot on the stick that really worked for me, like telling me I could go look at the book about sharks if I finished my math homework kind of stuff. And then they would, you know, move me through it. And then they would, the Montessori method worked really well for an ADHD kid and getting me excited about doing stuff and turning math into stories. There were some really wonderful educators that I grew up with back at Old Timberwild Elementary School back in San Antonio, Texas. And I don't even have the ability to, they'll never know that I'm in my 40s now and I don't stop thinking about the immeasurable patience and compassion that they showed towards the kid who was being bullied nonstop. And they created safe spaces for me when things got really bad and ugly. I hope anybody out there, folks like, for example, Josh Allen, who are connected to these communities, the profound impact that that presence has to kids. I'm sure you've, especially in this day and age, as we are a generation that grew up being those kids, the impact is life saving. And so, that's where my gratitude goes to.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric. Gosh, I could go on and on about gratitude. I'll just hit a couple real quick. First, Josh, you hit it right on. Therapists are so valuable now. Like the therapist I have right now, she was so affirming. Like when like the last 8 years or so have been super hard, just with the global world and the pandemic and the politics and just everything, everything, right? And when I was going on in a session with her about how positive my RPG sessions were and how great it was to have this release, this escape valve with friends in a safe space just to create something cool and amazing. She was so affirming. She was like super positive, super affirming. And like, yeah, absolutely embrace that. Go for it. You know, put your whole heart into it and let the rest of the world just go away for a little while. Cause that's, you know, helping so much. And I was like, it was one of the few times in my life that I can remember somebody actually affirming my hobby and saying, yes, that's okay. You can go do that. Right. And you would think that it would happen more often, but it doesn't, obviously, right? So it was really powerful to have a therapist be able to say, look, this is A-okay. I want to thank Eric, and I want to thank Sam, and I want to thank everybody who was involved with Shield of Tomorrow and Clear Skies and Blood of the Void, all of them. And obviously, because you have blazed the trail, and you have led by example for 7 years now. And there are so many other groups out there who have done likewise, who are sharing their experiences, sharing their videos, sharing their stuff online, showing everybody how much fun this can be and how positive of a hobby this can be. And so thank you so much for doing that. I also have to thank all the game masters and players that I played with back in the day, who I did not realize were so formative in my life until you can look back and go, oh shit, they were really formative in my life, right? And it's funny that two of my game masters who I first started playing the hobby with both grew up to become therapists, right? Which is like, okay, there's a thing, right? There's a thing in the RPG space. I think Sam, you touched on this a little bit, how neurodivergence has always been a thing. Even back in the day when Gen X, we didn't have the language to explain what it was, right? We didn't know. Like, I mean, I'm sure some people knew, but like, I didn't have that vocabulary when I was a kid. Nobody did, as far as I can remember. Anyway, so thanks to those game masters and players of all my original groups, because you helped in ways that we probably couldn't have even imagined. So thank you for that. And then finally, thank you to all the fans. All the fans, especially, we touched on this earlier in the episode, who are out there creating, not to say job aids, but who are creating game aids and tools and apps and videos and infographics and just all this stuff that a game company can't even conceive of, because we don't have the time or whatever, or we just don't even know. We don't know what we don't know, right? But when you get things out into the world, and then a fan goes, oh, this is pretty good, but I can make this character sheet better, or I can make this little tool better, and it'll help teach the game differently. Like that is the lifeblood of a well-supported game, in ways that like Modiphius can't support the game as well as the fan base can. And that shows me just how healthy the game is that people are out there making really cool stuff, not just to make cool stuff, but to make cool stuff to help other people play the game better, learn the game better, learn the game more effectively, whatever. And I am grateful to everybody who does that, because it's just so it's so affirming of how great this hobby is, that they are inspired to create it just for the love, right? Not just the love of Star Trek, but the love of gaming and the love for, you know, your fellow players. And I would just enjoin everybody, when you get into gaming, like carry that love forward, right? And just like embrace everybody at the table and just have fun. So anyway, I'll stop there.
This was awesome. Great show. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Josh. I mean, what a great show. Never would have thought, you know, this is a show 125 that we would have got this far, now tackling such important subjects. So thank you all for accepting the invitation and helping us be more IDIC.
Live long and prosper, y'all. Be safe and be well. Talk to you next time.